Jonathan, I want to go back to, we were walking at the Lean Summit, the three of us, myself, Mark and Daniel, and we asked you for, like, just give us a random bit of advice, and you told a story about something that Bob Proctor said to you. Can you share that with us now?
I'm not sure if I can. What?
You're just full of so much value that you just can't even remember what you said. We said, whenever you go to events,
oh yes,
you know, do you have any tips of how to make the most of your time, basically?
Yeah. So, yeah, we went to a Bob Proctor event, and the three of us were sitting at one table. And like this, when you're at one table, you can talk to a limited number of people. And Bob Proctor pulled us to the side and he said, "You're wasting valuable opportunities." He said, "This room's full of people that you could be talking to. It's the three of you should never be eating together at the one place at an event like this." So from that day to this, and you've seen it at the Lean Summit, we just split up. So today is unique to have the three of us around the one table, because we have taken that advice very seriously. And you notice we go to conferences, we go to events, exhibitions, we'll be in three different corners of the room.
Yeah.
But you're full of so much knowledge that it takes three of us to absorb what you're going to say.
I'm on the receiving end today. I'm the one lobbing the questions out and seeing where we go. So, yeah, look, we're here today with the Tierney brothers. We have Ryan, Jonathan, Martin. I've been calling you guys the Tierney Trinity. And it's a real honour to have you both around the same table. And it's a really big deal for us. And we're really excited to see where this conversation goes. You guys represent a lot of different businesses. The more time I spend with you, I'm like, wait, and you also do that? And you also do that? And what's this? The kind of flagship business, it would be fair to say, would be Seating Matters.
Absolutely,
yeah. Started by your mum. And we'll get into that story a little bit later on. But I would love to go back. I'd love to go back to your childhood, because something that I see in all three of you, and it's only recently I've been able to meet you, Martin, and meet you, Jonathan, is that... And it was only when I met your mum at the Lean Summit that it all fell into place. It's like, you guys have a head for business, you have a heart for people, and you've got this weird third ingredient that not all people have, and that's a bit of soul. And so if we kind of take those three categories, head, heart, and soul, look at your childhood. Let's do head first. Like, what were you guys doing when you were kids? Like, did you get dessert if you listened to Bob Proctor tapes? Or, like, did you have to do 20 business push-ups before you go to bed? Like, where does your business acumen come from?
Probably one of the earliest memories that we have is, driving along in the car with our parents, our mother, or separately our father, or when they're together, and they're talking about things that they're going to do and things they're going to try, and next year we're going to do this, and we're going to do that, and we're going to be doing another. And they had always... plans and ideas of things they were going to do, and both of them had their own businesses. My father always, and my mother later life started her own business, but they're always entrepreneurial. And I want a very early quote that stands out: "Readers are leaders." They used to tell us that over and over and over again. And we just read and studied and listened to a lot of things, and sought out good people to listen to, always.
Interesting. Yeah. What were some of the books that you would have found on your parents' bookshelf?
Our father's favourite book was probably The Magic of Thinking Big, and he quoted it a lot.
Who is that? Is that Robbins, or who is that?
I'm going to say Dennis Waitley, but I'm not sure. Is that right?
It's probably pre-Robbins.
Yeah.
It is, yeah. It's like an 1880s book, yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
So it was something he would have read a lot, but we also... In them days, they talked about books and tapes. So they would have tapes in the car when we were driving along. We'd be listening to seminars and listening to Les Brown and and people like that. So I think it was a mix of that plus work. We spent every Saturday and as many days as we could get off school as possible going to work with our father. And we just grew up. Work was normal. Work was fun for us. We loved getting away. And they were long days. Father worked in construction. And so it was no 9 to 5. He worked like long, long hours. And I suppose it wasn't until later years when we became teenagers and, maybe had our own car or whatever, that we started to realize how long these hours were. We thought it was normal when we were really young.
Yeah.
I met somebody yesterday and he asked what football team I played for. I says, the first time I was in the gates of our local football club was last year when I took my son. Never was in the gate before in my life. Our hobby was power flipping concrete. But I remember one Christmas, Daddy was setting up concrete for a big job in Annalee, and we had to put down this reinforcing steel. So my job was to put the bricks in underneath the steel to hold it up off the ground, but I wasn't strong enough to lift it up. So Jonathan and Ryan lifted up the steel, and I pushed in the bricks. And I distinctly remember looking out the window and seeing these lights in the sky and wondering, was that Santa's sleigh?
Wow. So there you are having your Coca-Cola moment while like laying concrete.
So I must have been like, you know, no more than 18 because I believed in Santa. It was definitely at primary school, and it must have been like Christmas Eve, and we were out getting ready to put down concrete. So that was just normal.
You must have been very young. That's the way we grew up, and I think we thought that was normal, and I think we've continued that. But it was definitely a mix of work and learning.
Yeah. Anything, Ryan, like from when you were really wee, like what did you get up to? Like what were your antics? Like three brothers, I must have been mad. You have a sister as well.
Yeah, we have a sister, Louise, yeah. She's 10 years younger than Martin. And she's very successful as well. She's got her own business. But back when we were really young, we can't remember starting to work. It's just like we can't remember not working.
Mm.
And when us three were young, we used to sell turf. So we used to go to the mountain and dig turf and sell it locally around the doors.
He's from Belfast, he doesn't know what that is.
is that from a Seamus Heaney poem or what is that?
But it was some learning for us because we used to cut turf, bag it, go around the door selling it. We didn't even, we weren't old enough to drive. Our mother or father would help us to deliver the turf. We'd collect the money. And it was always a pound a bag. And we still, even to this day, we still say, oh, that's 100 bags of turf. Or that's 1,000 bags of turf. Or that's 200,000 bags of turf. We relate everything we buy now back to the amount that a bag
really
of turf was. So it kind of made us, from an early age, respect the value of money, didn't it?
Yes.
It really did. Because everything came back to, that's 100 bags of turf.
Yeah.
We can't be buying that.
Yeah.
So that's the way we were kind of brought up with that. Everything related to turf.
And there's a queer amount of work in getting turf out of the ground, never mind into the bag, never mind delivering it. It's really interesting. I think a key point is that your mum and or your dad helped you run that small business.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Whenever, you know, objectively speaking, it wasn't a good use of their time, but they realised the investment they were making into you.
Yeah.
Absolutely, yeah.
Exactly. I remember, like, when we were 7, 8, 9, having T-shirts with Never Give Up. Readers are leaders, all this kind of stuff. It was just ingrained in our thinking to always be positive. You know, we always believed we could do anything. That was, we were brought up like that.
But I think the important difference is like positive or listen to a book or you know, Bob Proctor and things like that. There's a lot of people get carried away with, oh, that's this American positivity, like rah rah, we can do it kind of stuff. But they forget that you actually have to set your alarm for 5 a.m. to get up, you know?
Yeah.
And that you have to go to the airport and drive the van the length of the country to actually get to that appointment tomorrow morning.
Yeah.
Like, you can't sit there and, you know, manifest things to come through.
Oh, it's a good point, because there's a lot of folks who, you know, oh, I'm gonna read that Bob Proctor book for the 20th time. Actually, we interviewed these guys. You ever heard of The Priests? They're from Northern Ireland. They're singers.
Yeah.
They're amazing. They describe themselves as the fastest selling boy band of all time. Classical boy band. I just love that. So anyone who has known, three priests, they're literally full time Catholic priests working, I think, mainly up in Derry. And they're like world record Sony classical musicians to sell, that they do numbers, you know, they perform in front of the Pope and all sort of stuff. But one of them, they said, no one has ever ploughed a field by turning it over in their mind.
Wow.
And I think that it can be so easy to get caught into the, oh, let's read all these books, let's all read all these books. But actually, you need to do that while also climbing up the mountain, getting ready to dig the turf out of the ground.
Yeah, exactly.
Brutal.
Yeah. And it is hard work to do, as you said. But I remember being at school thinking that other people must be rich because they were throwing pounds into vending machines for bottles of Coke at lunchtime. And I would never have done that. I was like, but that's a full bag of turf.
That boy just ate three bags of turf for his lunch.
takes forever to make that kind of money.
Yeah.
You know? And then when you went to buy a pair of Nike trainers, it was definitely like you were really counting up then. So we suppose the value of money came from that too. So
interesting. For me, I always related it back to my first job was a busboy, and it was £4 an hour, and it was also £4 to go to the cinema. So I always in my head was, oh, this is 2 cinema tickets, or this is 5 cinema tickets. But yeah. I think bag of turf is a far better metaphor. Yeah. See, your mum and dad, were they abnormal in comparison to the people around them? Or did they have a community of like-minded abnormal people, for lack of a better term?
I think they're different. Like, they're definitely unique. Our mother wrote a book actually for her grandchildren. We've got children. Each of us have children. She wrote a book of her story for her grandchildren's interest, and then she printed 10 more copies and gave them to her friends, and then she printed 30 more and gave them to her relatives. And she's given or sold hundreds of them at this stage. But
actually, just bought one yesterday off Amazon.
Oh, very good.
Yeah. Looking forward to it. Yeah,
but like, when you see where they started, you know, they lived in rural Northern Ireland in the 60s. No electricity, no water, you know, like no money, you know. And everyone was in the same boat. That's just the way society was back then. And they got from where they are to where they brought us, which was an incredible jump.
Mm.
And where we started, you know, if we do the same amount of growth as they did, you know, God knows how high that is. You know, but from them to go from no electric, no water, mm-hmm. living out in, you know, to having a car and a nice house and a business, like, that's incredible growth. And they had to have a unique mindset to do that.
Mm-hmm. And that is, like, that's the power of generations, I guess. You know, like, people talk about standing on the shoulders of giants. You know, even just mathematically speaking, so what, there was 4 of you growing up. And now, how many kids do you have between you at the minute? It's probably hard to...
Seven.
Yeah. Are you done? Are you going to have more? Mm-hmm.
Well, we'll see.
So Martin's going to have 4 more. So mathematically speaking, you know, if you continue to invest in your families, as I know each of you as fathers and husbands and men do, you know, can you just imagine like what the clan can achieve in even 100 years? It's crazy.
Yeah, absolutely. It's one of them things that, you know, you think about as a parent where, you know, Warren Buffett, you know, it's an extreme amount of wealth, but he said he's not leaving any money to his children or but in a way, if every generation didn't leave their children better than they were, we would be going back the ways, or, you know, you wouldn't grow and put your children back in a cave, you know?
Yeah.
So, like, our parents did a great job bringing us to here. So it's only right that we do the same for the next generation, allow them to grow. And I think maybe older generations don't understand younger generations, but it's all advancement, it's all improvement, and sometimes they get a bad rap for some of the things, but when you look at it, they're advancing in their own way. You look around here, our grandparents wouldn't understand any of these businesses that's in this building, VR, but it's massive advanced in technology and thinking, and, you know, where can they go with that? It's unbelievable.
We interviewed a 94-year-old woman a few years ago, and she was in this room, and she kind of went like this, and she went, hold on a second, this is actually where the diving board used to be. And that's the swimming pool. And I used to be a lifeguard here.
Oh.
So for your grandparents' generation, it's like this building was a swimming pool and a bathhouse. And now it houses 100 tech entrepreneurs doing all sorts of stuff. Yeah. So it's mind-boggling how the speed and the rate of change has just got so exponential. Yeah. So, okay, I'm happy with head. I feel like we've covered that first bit relatively enough. Because the reason why I think you're so interesting, the reason why I call you Trinity as well, is because, like, there's plenty of people out there in the business world who are all head, as in, like, it's like they know how to make loads of money, but they'll maybe be brutal, they'll be savage, you know, they'll almost be violent in the way that they make money. And what has always stood out, first with Ryan and then, you know, the two of you guys, is that you have the business smarts, but also this, like, insane heart, this insane compassion side. Where does the heart come from, do you think, if you kind of pull back childhood and all that sort of stuff?
I would say maybe from her mother, coming from a caring profession. She's an occupational therapist, probably stemming from that, I would say. Her whole desire was to help and contribute and support and care for her patients. And probably that, I would say, that filtered down into us. So in business, it's not just numbers and statistics and product and productivity and efficiency. There is a real heart behind everything we're doing. And that's evident in everything we're doing. The way we serve our customers, the way we treat our people, I think that's very evident. Yeah,
I think if you go back to the origins of seating matters, our father had a construction company, but for 8 years he was making chairs for our mother just to help her patients.
Wow.
So, and that wasn't a business for them. My father was just helping my mother achieve her goals and what she wanted to do. It wasn't until 8 years later that the three of us decided, you know, well, there's more than one OT in the world that could benefit from this. And we made it into a business. So the heart of Seating Matters started purely from, you know, caring about the patient, caring about the people that are looking after the patients.
Hmm.
So
that compassion, I think, is really powerful. And like, Ryan's got me reading the Tired Away at the minute. And that's the thing that really stands out to me, is like, they're so focused on service.
Yeah.
And I think that's really powerful. It's not about just printing money and making cars as fast as possible. It's like, they want to contribute back to society. That's quite rare.
Yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Actually, another story I've just remembered about, you'll maybe tell this one, Martin, better than me, but our father done lots of construction work. And if he'd done a job for somebody that didn't have the money, he would have done it for free.
Wow.
And he did lots of times. Maybe you know the story about the guy down south. You don't have to say his name, but...
Our father died almost 10 years ago. And one of the guys that worked for him came to us afterwards and says, this man, I know that your father didn't get paid for that job, and we didn't know this. And he says, and I've been in touch with him. He says, we should go down and visit him. And down afterwards, and the guy says, yeah, I actually did pay your father, but he realised that our milking parlour wasn't up and going, so we weren't making money. And on the way at the door, he set the check in the top of the fridge and walked out. You know, because he knew that customer of his had not yet turned a profit from their investment, and he wasn't going to take his money until he knew the customer was making money.
That's crazy.
Yeah. But like, a lot of those things, he done all these things and never told a soul.
Mm.
You know, he didn't tell anybody those things. And maybe only after he died did we realise the extent of the things that he did. You know, story after story after story of helping people that were, you know, in jail, that were... kicked out of their family, that were, you know, helping people bury their relatives or paying for people's weddings and all this stuff, that anonymous people that we don't know, you know, come and tell us these stories, and definitely makes an impact on your outlook in life. Because what's it all for? Like, it's the impact that you leave on other people is what's most important.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think when something really bad happens, you know, people have this saying, oh, everything happens for a reason. I think one gift we got from, you know, our father passing was learning who he really was and learning stories like that. And it really, you know, we talk a lot about looking after your people and looking after the customer. What we realised when he passed and at his funeral and for years after it, his customers were his best friends.
Wow.
You know, he had really, there was no business relationship there anymore. He had really become friends with these people. He knew their families. He supported them. And likewise, they supported him.
Mm.
And, you know, we knew them. We didn't realize they were customers or didn't realize that's how the relationship started until you really sat back and thought about it afterwards. So
yeah,
it's definitely left an imprint on us. And we're in the healthcare business. If you don't, you know, care is in the in the name. So I think, and that's why we do have other businesses, but Seating Matters is the passion.
Yeah.
It's the one where we can really live our purpose, because it gives us all three things that you're talking about.
Mm.
And, you know, there's other ones that maybe can answer a question financially or whatever, but does it give you the heart to get up in the morning?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's where Seating Matters really does
absolutely
stand out for that, yeah.
How old was your father when he died?
He was 52.
And this is James?
Mm-hmm.
So 52, you guys were still really young.
Yeah, and yeah. So our sister was...
The business was still young.
14, I was 24, 25, 26, yeah.
How did that impact you all as I was going to say brothers, but actually I'm more interested in as men.
I remember as soon as a few weeks after he passed away, we all got together and we just said, let's make this thing big. Let's go at it 100 mile an hour. And we really did. It just gave us some motivation. It must have been just to distract our minds. We wanted to put all our energy and effort into something. And since that happened, the business has just taken off. We're we're serving more customers than we've ever served. I think we just diverted that energy into something, and that something was the business.
Mm-hmm.
And it just took off like a rocket. Like, it's unrecognizable from the way it was when he was here with us.
I think I'm not, I haven't read a whole lot of stuff about, you know, being a stoic or whatever, but I think when you live through that, you don't have to read it to understand that life is short. And I think it was Ryan that probably highlighted that. You tell it better. You were half the age when, you don't think when you're that young that you're possibly halfway there.
Wow.
So it creates a sense of urgency, because you can't sit around forever. And, you know, it's something I see. You're listening to conversations, you're talking to people, and they're like, oh, you know, the kid's at school, and, you know, and the kid's 30. He's not a kid, like, but, you know, people, I think we were lucky that we had the opportunity to grow up fast.
Mm-hmm.
We found our sense of purpose early in life, and I think make the most of it because we know we can. Whereas some people, and, you know, maybe it's no fault of their own, but, you know, if you don't find that till later, or you're drifting, you know, for a while, I think that's where we're really privileged, and, you know, part of our father passing maybe sped that up a bit for us. So.
Yeah, really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
We've kind of maybe drifted into the soul realm. I don't even really know what I'm looking to get out of the soul realm, but maybe a way to approach it, and please feel free to take it any direction you want to or you feel comfortable to. Is there anything that your parents did, whether it's a practice or a habit or a routine with you guys, that you now do with your own kids?
Yeah.
Someone asked me the other day, like, what age was it when we started Seating Matters? And I was thinking, like, what my mother said on the day that I left school, like, would I say that to my children? I do not know if I would or not. You know, I was trying to think back into, like, so I was in secondary school, and I came home from school one day, and I says, I'm going to leave and we're going to start Seating Matters. I was, you know, halfway through my final year in Limavady Grammar School.
Well, my fun fact about you is that you also happen to be head boy.
Head boy of the school, yeah. And I said, I'm going to leave school after my January exams. This is in December. And my mother said, why? I said, well, I'll go to university. I'll be an engineer. I'll be a doctor. I'll be something or whatever. And I'll end up back in Seating Matters anyway. So it's just delaying the decision. If we just start now, you know, it'll speed the thing up a little bit. So I'm going to go back to school, finish my January exams, pass them all, and then I'm going to leave. And my mother said, well, if you're going to leave, why don't you leave tomorrow?
Oh, my goodness.
And I did. And Jonathan left his work, and Ryan left his work, and I left school. And that Thursday morning, we kind of officially started Seating Matters. And I remember thinking, like, if my child came to me now, right, you best student in the school, and he's doing really well, and he says 6 months from the finish line, I'm going to stop and go somewhere else, I would probably say, oh, we're not quitters, you know, you finish that school. But no, she said, well, if you're going to do it, go and do it.
Wow.
Go ahead, yeah.
I think that's a real mark of my mother in particular. That was her line: if you're going to leave, why don't you leave tomorrow? Because out of all her brothers and sisters, she's the only one that went to university. So you know, they all done well, they've their own farms and businesses and things, but my mother saw the value in education. She saw that a university career is a good path for someone to choose.
Mm.
Her father didn't go to university, and he saw that there's also a good alternative to going to university. But she wasn't blinkered by the fact of, oh, well, my son's going to get a degree.
Yeah.
She says, well, if you're going to leave, just leave.
Crazy.
Yeah.
So, you know, sorry, Ryan, you go.
No, it's okay, yeah. I'll have to edit this out now.
No. We roll with it here. Roll through the pauses. You were going to say
I was just going to say, I still remember that day after that Martin left, because it was the whole talk of the town. Everybody was talking about it. Martin Tierney left school. He was the head boy, and it was just crazy. It was a crazy time. But that next day, that Thursday morning, I still remember it. Martin was sitting at a computer. There was like two files beside this, like, a real big square laptop. I was in the factory trying to make this one chair. Jonathan was in the van, maybe waiting on it to be finished to go and deliver it to show a customer. That's where it started. It was so small.
Wow.
One wee tiny office and one workshop with the size of this room. One workbench. That just brought me back to that.
Yeah. What were you two guys working at the time?
I actually worked with my mother, and she ran the disability centre where she'd done assessments. Based in the northwest, a lot of people at that time, if they needed that type of service, would have to come to Belfast. So there were a lot of people around Derry, Donegal, you know, that were sick. It was a lot of travelling for them. So she set up a base in the northwest for that. So I was actually helping her. So I was in the healthcare space and, you know, probably helped us see that opportunity because I was working yeah. in it.
Mm-hmm.
But I'd like to go back to a conversation that I had with my father, similar to what Martin was saying. And we were talking, like, we had ambitions, you know, to start our own business. And I didn't even know what it was at the time. And I remember talking to him and saying, you know, what would be a good thing to study, like, if you want to run your own business? You know, like, maybe I should become a solicitor, or maybe I should become an accountant. And her father said, well, if there's 100 roles within a company and you specialise in one, you still have to pay the other 99. So why not just pay the 100 of them? You know, instead of wasting 5 years, you know, in his opinion, for me.
Yeah.
Now, it's not a waste if that's your dedication, but school probably wasn't my dedication, and he was smart enough to see that. And maybe in my mind, I thought I had to do these steps before I can start the business, and he just eliminated that thought. He's like, you're going to have to recruit every other job. Why not just add one to that list?
And yeah. Really interesting.
So it takes the pressure off.
I think that's inner thinking as a family. Like, we don't think like normal people. You know, you question everything. Why are you doing that? But why can you not try this way or try something else? And that came from our background. Like, no, just leave school now. Just don't go to university. Think different.
Yeah.
So think different is probably the theme of our family. We don't think like the masses.
Yeah.
I remember Bob Proctor saying, if you see 100 people going in this direction and there's one going the other direction, he says, follow the one and you'll never make another mistake as long as you live.
Mm-hmm. That's so a crazy
that's
statement.
Kind of the way we think. If there's 100 going this way and one going this way, we're going with the one.
How did you guys meet Bob Proctor?
So other podcast in the talk.
Do you know the story?
I've no idea, no.
Oh, wow. So
I've got my own perspective on the story, but go first.
I've told this story a few times. Usually we're not on a podcast, so I don't know how it goes down when it's recorded. It's on record now. But myself and Ryan had been to Australia, and we went away for, it was supposed to be a 3-week trip, and we ended up being away for 9 weeks traveling. I was 18, I think you were 17 or 18 and 19, something around that. And on our way home again, after being away for 3 months, we saw this cruise, Bob Proctor cruise, and there was all these speakers, Jack Canfield, and all these big names that, you know, we had only ever read their books before.
Yeah.
And we thought, wow, like this would be unbelievable. So we went home, and our parents right away thought, well, gee, that would be a great trip. And we took a friend with us as well, and who had read all the books, and so off we went to the Mexican Riviera cruise. And on day two of the cruise, you know, the cruise line's typical stops in different places. So how it worked, when you were on the boat, they ran seminars, and you could go to different, you know, theatres, and you could hear them talking. And then during the day, you get off the boat like a normal holiday, and you went and sightseed or whatever. We went, Ryan and I and another friend of ours went and hired out 3 jet skis.
Okay.
And we were told in Spanish, you know, this and that, and what we were to do and what we were not to do. And one of the instructions that we didn't listen to was you weren't allowed to pass these buoys because it was going into the Mexican Navy water. But we didn't really listen to that. And the next thing, we were out on these massive waves, and Ryan came out over a wave and crashed into my jet ski. Smashed the 2 jet skis, and we got arrested by the Armada de Mexico.
Meanwhile, me and my sister are see all these police cars going down to this harbour, and we're just thinking, God, I wonder what's going on down there.
My
drugs raid or something.
So, and
these 2 boys are paraded in front of us.
we were brought back to a different pier than we had rented the jet skis from, and they were chatting away to us in Spanish, and all machine guns, and we were there in our swimming shorts and not a word of Spanish between us. And Like they were asking us all these questions, asking us for ID and passports. We're like, well, you know, we're in our shorts.
Yeah.
And luckily this Canadian lady saw us and she walked down. She could speak Spanish and she had seen all this before. And, you know, Mexico was known for being corrupt. So they were trying to get a few dollars off us. And she came down and she negotiated in Spanish for them, for us. And she turned around and she said, they need 10,000 American dollars to fix the two jet skis. And we looked at each other and we're like, she's in on this. Like,
yeah.
She's part of the scam.
She's skimming some off the top here. Yeah.
But after we went, we realized that we didn't have many other options. We were, you know, at the end of a pier with no other options. So we took a chance on the lady and she took out a card and she paid for us. And she walked us back to the cruise. And luckily the cruise ship counted the people going off and had noticed that there was two people missing. And when they checked who they were, they realized that we were part of a family and that they can't split a family. So if all of us had been off the ship, they actually leave. So it was lucky that the rest of the family were back on the ship.
Nice.
But we held up the ship of, I don't know how many thousand people were all waiting to depart.
3,000 people.
Oh, my goodness.
And everyone on the ship knew that there was a delay, and it soon got around that there was a delay because two guys have crashed the jet skis and they've got arrested and we have to wait on them. So when we got back on the boat, Bob Proctor sent word that he wanted to meet the two guys that held up the whole boat.
The two boys from Belfast that sunk a ship.
So that's how we met Bob Proctor. And we were on a boat with thousands of people. We wouldn't have had the opportunity. We actually had the opportunity. We went to his private suite. We sat down with him. We talked to him. And we actually, like, we still attribute that trip to the start of Seaton Matters becoming something big, because we were thinking Northern Ireland. We were thinking, you know, our own area service. And he was like, you need to get this to America, you know. So from the very origins of Seaton Matters, we were thinking, wow, this needs exported.
So, the lady, Gina, who paid the money, actually, was Bob Proctor's right-hand woman.
Oh, wow.
So she paid the money, and then we paid her back over time.
Yeah, and she's still saved in my phone as Guardian Angel.
So, I mean, how do you respond to that? How do you navigate that conversation with Bob? Like, was he kind of like,
oh, he loved
angry
it.
Principal, or was he just loving it?
He loved it.
We thought we were
going to be in trouble for holding back his boat, and he thought this was the best. He loved it so much.
Wow. So, way to make an impression.
Yeah.
But since that, you know, we went to the Bob Proctor's suite at the top deck of the hotel or the cruise, and we really got his attention. We were sitting across the table from Bob Proctor. Like, we'd seen him on movies, we've read all his books, we'd seen him on YouTube, and we were sitting across the table from him. He had our attention, and we got so much valuable information. And then he actually invited us to his home.
No way.
After that, yeah. And we were there twice in Toronto. We spent 2 or 3 days with him, and he coached us one-on-one because he knew us as the three Irish guys that are a bit crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Crazy? Wow. So how
do you guys? We got called on the.
Is that
ship.
What the nickname was? The infamous name.
I'm allowed to go to Mexico, but they're not.
What was it? Do you think, why did Bob extend that extra invitation to you? Like, was it because you were Irish? Was it because you had a twinkle in your eye? Like, what? Why do you think there was something about you guys that grabbed him?
I think when we got the opportunity to meet him, we'd kind of, like, we could quote him inside out. So we knew when we met him, we had the questions in our head.
Yeah.
You know, we were told, are you going to meet Bob Proctor? Like, we had been on that cruise with the hope to meet Bob Proctor. So we were going there with a mission.
Yeah.
And so, like, when we got in front of him, like, we made the most of it. And I think he saw that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, there you go. You can sit in your room and manifest to try to meet Bob Proctor. You can crash a couple of skis and see what happens.
Do whatever it takes, eh?
100%. So one of the things I kind of want to cover as well is, and that we'll probably actually spend the rest of our time kind of on this, is I'm curious to know, like, what each of your superpowers are and how each of you work with each other. So, Martin, like, you're the youngest of the three. what is it like that you're, what's your specialty or what's your superpower that's different to these two guys sitting across from you?
Probably easier for somebody else to answer that on my behalf.
Well, maybe, do you want to do it that way?
I can answer that for
There you go. Let's do that.
God knows what he's going to say. Maybe I'll answer myself.
No, that's a far better way of doing it. What do you think Martin's superpower is?
But now that I'm in trouble with Mexico on a podcast, I'm about to get in trouble with my GCSE results.
Oh, perfect.
So Martin has always just been good at detail. Like he said, he was head boy of the school. He was, you know, really, really... He got one B in his whole life, and I think it was in PE.
You didn't need him. You didn't need to do him like that.
But to give you an example of Martin, I was doing my GCSE English, and I didn't really know what I was supposed to be doing. And Martin did my coursework for me, and he was like second or third year.
Unbelievable.
So
I was just for sport. Was this because you were a good brother? Was there an exchange of services?
I had to pay him. Absolutely, had to pay him.
Would you pay him bags of turf? Sweet.
But I think we've always known where Martin excelled. So, and we've always been good at using each other's. You know, I'm not good at this, Martin. Would you do this for me?
Yeah.
So even at school, Martin done my coursework, and I think that's still the case. Like there's certain emails and there's customers now that will know. Jonathan, I'm sending this to you. You can forward it on to Martin if you think. So if it comes to the detail-oriented stuff, something that needs a lot of deep thinking, that's where Martin excels. And I think both of us are glad to have that.
Martin, you've given us a great idea. I'm going to use this in podcasts all the time now, where you just say the next person. So what do you think Ryan's superpower is?
Have you ever heard of Lean before?
I'm beginning to hear more and more about it. Yeah, I am.
So the 2 second Lean Summit is just finished a couple of weeks ago, and Paul Ecker sent me a WhatsApp there just yesterday. So he's the author of the book 2 second Lean, and it's kind of his community it brought together. But we were asked to host it at Seton Matters, and he just sent a message. He said that if we wanted to do it again, he would say yes in 3 seconds.
Why 3 seconds?
I don't know.
It's very off-brand.
2 seconds. So obviously that summit is down to Ryan's work, his commitment to it. Jonathan and I kind of intellectually understood Lean at the very start, but it was Ryan's drive to make it happen that made sure that we're leading in Lean.
Yeah.
If it was up to me and Jonathan, it probably would have been... 10 or 20% of what it is, you know.
So what is it about Ryan, like behind Lean, that allowed him to make Lean so successful?
I think focus is one of Ryan's favourite words. So pick something and stick with it until it's done. So I find that more challenging to do, maybe Jonathan as well, but Ryan can focus on something and see it through to the very end.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So anything like whether it's in business or even pre-business that you kind of like, if someone was looking objectively at Ryan, like, yeah, this guy's an operations guy or a process guy.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the fact there's companies coming from around the world to visit our factory shows that there's something special about that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool. Ryan, what about Jonathan?
Yeah, I think the best way to describe Jonathan is when Jonathan got married, 3 years ago?
Three years ago.
Daniel, can you fact check that for us? Can you fill
it out? 21. It actually was 21.
So with 3 years ago, I was asked to be best man. We were both best men because he couldn't make a difference on us.
Like
so I was one of the best men, and I was obviously preparing a speech. And I hadn't anything prepared because I didn't know what I was going to say. What do you say about Jonathan? So... 2 weeks up, leading up, 1 week up, 3 days up, 2 days off the wedding. I still didn't know what I was going to say. And the day before the wedding, I sat down and I read a poem.
Wow.
Yeah, and I've never read a poem in my life before, but I sat down and it just all came to me. I don't know how it came, but I just knew that I just got a bit of paper and I started writing and I just read this amazing poem about Jonathan, and it's called A Man, The Man That Knows a Man. So Jonathan knows people everywhere, New York, Las Vegas, Sydney, Tokyo. He knows people absolutely
wow.
all over the planet. He just has a gift for connecting with people
yeah.
and networking, and that's not my thing at all. I would far rather be in the background. So Jonathan's gift is networking. He knows people all over the world. He's got his phone, his contact list is massive. I think that's maybe Jonathan's superpower, is connecting with people.
Yeah.
And the poem at the wedding really summed that up.
The man who knows a man.
Yeah.
That's a good biography title as well.
It's a class poem, it really is. So I'm just moving into a new house in the next few weeks. And it's the first thing when you go in the door is the poem is printed out and framed. And
class.
So it was definitely something good.
Very cool.
Another thing, like Martin says about focus, he's not sure if, like, you've heard Martin talk at the Lean Summit. You know, Martin has a heart that's so big. And some of his stories, and some of it's personal and some of it's, but, you know, the way he goes above and beyond to help people has been to, like, you have this in common, being in Haiti after the earthquake. And, you know, there's things like that I feel there's things me and Ryan wouldn't do. Martin is like that. There's things Ryan does that me and Martin won't do, and, you know, and I think I heard recently on a podcast that people that are using their gift, it comes so naturally to you that you don't think it's a gift. And I think that's why it's better to answer each other's question there. But it also, it's not until you really reflect on it that you realize there's value in it. So when Ryan says, that's my superpower, I'm like, oh, I thought everybody done that.
Yeah, everybody.
You know, because you enjoy it, or, you know, if that's what you're into, it feels easy. It doesn't feel like you're... a superpower. It doesn't feel special. It doesn't add value.
There's a lady called Caroline McKenna who really helped me to understand that. And she asked me the same thing. What's your superpower? When are you most in flow or in the zone, or when are you most alive? And I'm not sure. And we just started to chat and talk about it. And I met her through the Scale X program with Brenton and Claire.
Class.
And I started to tell her the story, and she goes, wow, she says, that's an amazing story. That is your superpower. And then reflecting on it, you know, it's a really important day, I think, in your life when you can realize what that is. And I think I deeply understand that now, and then make the most of it, make the most of the gift that every person has been given.
Yeah. And I think to your point, it's really interesting just talking about superpowers. Because it comes so naturally to you, you can almost feel like, oh, I'm not slacking off, but like, it's not like digging turf. Do you know what I mean? It's like, it flows so well for you, where you're like, well, I need to do something that's really, 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 really hard. And like, I have to feel the sweat and you'll get plenty of that elsewhere. But it's amazing whenever you can tap into that, like, I don't know, I'm mixing so many metaphors here and I'm thinking of jet skis at the same time. It's like if you're a surfer and you can just catch that wave. You know, and you can just really take that wave somewhere really, really special.
Yeah. It's funny as well, the way the three roles kind of just all work together. Like if an email comes in about a black tie event in Dublin, well, Jonathan's obviously going to go. If there's a speaking engagement in London, well, it's obviously Martin will answer that one.
Yeah.
And if we have to build it or extend the factory, I'll do it. It kind of works so well.
Absolutely.
And nobody has to say, do you want to do that? Or will I do that? You just, that's obviously Martin. That's obviously me. That's obviously Jonathan.
Yeah. I was chatting to Mark Braun, who was speaking at the summit, and we were having a conversation over dinner. And I was asking, you know, why do you think Seat Matters is so successful? And there was a group discussion. There was a healthy debate. These are all the conversations you guys don't get to hear. And Mark Braun turned around. He says, it's the brothers. He says, it's the synergy and the complementary superpowers of the brothers. So you guys have been given a real gift to be born into a family with a mum and dad that have prepared you in the way that they've prepared you. You've been given a great gift to have such great relationships with each other. Obviously, there's a lot of nurturing in there as well. How do you guys protect that?
Just go back. I would challenge that a wee bit.
Please.
You know, in that it's not about us. It's definitely not. Like, you know, we were given a set of circumstances on the day that we were born, and we've got abilities that, you know, I've got my own abilities and Jonathan has their own abilities. It's not about us. It's about the people that need our chairs first and foremost. Like, this person, I was talking about him 3 days ago. His name is Barry, and he lived in Glace Bay, Nova Scotia, and he was a sailor. He worked in the Canadian Navy, and he had sailed all around the world. And we heard my accent. He asked where I was from, and I told him. He says, "Oh yes, I've been in Belfast, and I've been in Dublin, and I've been, you know, Sydney Harbour, and he'd been all these ports around the world." He is in this nursing home, staring at the floor, and he was on a peg feed because he had this kyphotic position. His back was curved, or like they would have called it a hump in your back years ago.
Sure.
This kyphotic posture, he couldn't swallow food. And a chair that we made in Limavady allowed that man to sit up. Crazy. Look out the window of this nursing home in Nova Scotia, Glace Bay. It was this beautiful place where Marconi sent his first radio transmission from Ballycastle, actually. And he was able to get off a peg feed and swallow food again in 7 weeks. And I remember seeing this man thinking, oh my God, we have to help more Barrys in the world. There's more people like him that are suffering and in pain, who have pressure ulcers, that are dying as a result of them.
Yeah.
And we have something that can help those people.
Yeah.
Like, it's nearly an obligation to help those people. And then outside of the industry that we're in, like, you look at companies like Cadbury, or I think it was the Lever Brothers maybe, or they set up their businesses as a force for good in their community.
Mm.
Like Bourneville, the village in Birmingham, Cadbury set that up with sports facilities and cricket pitches and houses and everything for the workers. Guinness did the same in Dublin. Yeah. Healthcare, hospitals, education. If a Guinness worker died, they paid the wages of the employee to his wife until the youngest child turned 18. So they used their business as a force for good. And I think from our perspective, what drives us on is, first of all, we've got we're up the Cairnamuff Road in Ballykelly. It's not exactly Manhattan. You know, there's a group of people there, brilliant, brilliant team of people that are actually relying on Seton Motors to pay their mortgage.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a group of patients out there that actually need the product that those people make. And in a big way, we're driven to help those people.
Absolutely.
It's about them.
Yeah.
And I think to add to that, you know, people that know us might think, you know, it's us here. But if you're in Australia, people in Australia don't know who we are.
Sure.
But the Seat Matters people in Australia see that exact same thing, that they want to help their patients. And I've spent 3 weeks there earlier in the year, and I've never felt more at home. I was like, I flew across the world and I'm with people that are exact same passion.
Crazy.
You go to Chicago and our team there, you go to the Midlands, like follow Connor Lynch on LinkedIn.
Mm-hmm.
He's one of the best in Seat Matters at social media. You know, if you want to see passion for helping patients. So it's throughout, and there's a certain amount that we can explain to somebody.
Yeah.
But it's when they go and take a person who has been in bed for months or years and get them up sitting into a chair, that totally changes the way they think, and then there's no stopping them. Once they've seen it, they can't unsee it.
Yeah.
Remember one of the first assessments I did was not too far from here, and the wee girl was called Dervla, and she was maybe 12, 13 years old, and her mother said, we need to get a chair for her so that she can come into the dining room in the house and sit with the rest of us. Postural complications and whatever, and you know, it's a challenge to sit up. And she wanted a chair with a reading lamp on it that had to be a specific width to get through the doorways because she had to get into the room with her mother. And I remember going back to the factory and Ryan's like, a reading lamp? Like, how do you put a reading lamp on a chair? I've never done that before. And you know, we went and get these components from suppliers and we made up this chair. And about 2 weeks later, I brought the chair back to this wee girl's house and went into the bedroom with the parents and the occupational therapist. And we get the wee girl, Dervla, her name was, sitting in the chair. And her mother started to cry. And she goes, that's so lovely, she says. Now we can bring her into the dining room to have lunch with us. And she goes, honestly, mommy, I'm 13, I don't want to sit with you. It was so funny because everybody had went to all this effort to make it perfect for her. And she's just like, well, I'm a teenager, I don't want to sit with her.
Teenager, be a teenager.
But just a lovely like family scenario that we were able to enable this bit of fun between the family with a product that,
yeah,
you know, our mother designed, our father made the first one, and you know, the team and seating matters are making them every day.
It's great. No, I appreciate the challenge you give, because I think those were really good points that you brought in. So I appreciate you stepping in. I think that was really important.
And then from my side, people wonder why you were so successful at Lean.
Yeah.
It's the pull from the customer.
Mm.
So at our morning meeting, as you've seen a few times, it's not we're making 20 chairs today. We're changing 20 people's lives today. So it's not a production target. It's 4:30. And we have to get 2 more chairs out before 5:00. That's 2 more people.
Mm.
It's not upholstery and metal and wood. It's 2 more people that we can serve in the next half an hour.
Yeah.
Let's get it out.
Absolutely.
And like, you know, members of our family have used our products in the end stages of their life. You know, you can't underestimate the impact that has on a person getting them out of bed, having them up and sitting and having their children coming in and having a conversation with them. They think, oh, he's doing really well. Look, he's up and sitting today. Mm. You know, change that person's life, memories for that family before their relative passed on, and like every single chair that we make, there's these incredible stories of human resilience behind it. Of, you know, people being cared for by ICU nurses like your wife. You know, totally compassionate, powerful people that are like putting their whole world on the line to care for a patient. And they're not doing it for money, because they're not paid well enough. They're doing it because they're compassionate, kind, caring people. And, you know, we're driven by that to try and help people like your wife do her job better in an ICU, or, you know, help a caregiver in a care home to care for a 90-year-old lady with no living relatives who has Parkinson's disease, or, you know.
So how do you keep it all together? There's plenty of families fall out, plenty of brothers start businesses. You know, the stakes are high, as you've laid out. There's people relying on you, your team of 60 people in Seat Matters and beyond. There's mortgages, there's families, there's communities. You're a force for good in Limavady. The further you go, the more there is at stake. And so between the three of you, how are you going to plan on keeping it all together and your relationships, keeping them together?
Yeah, it's something we think a lot about, to be honest, and we've got better at it over this past couple of years. We have good people advising us on how to structure things and organise things. But something we realised more recently is that all those things are easier if we're getting on better. Mm. We're trying to spend more time with each other, even doing this today. Like it's not often that we're all together, so we might go for a bit of lunch after this and try and spend more time together, because it is so easy to get so split up and everybody's in their own areas, and I'm in production and Jonathan's sales and Martin's doing finance or doing a speaking event somewhere, and we're all over the place. So it's trying to take time, and it's not easy. We're not saying we're perfect at it, but it's trying to take time to be together, I think, is a big part of it.
It's good.
I think we haven't always been good at it either. You know, we've managed to get to this point, but I think now it's being purposeful and doing it. You know, if we haven't done something together, it's like, right, when he's free, we'll go for a bite of lunch.
Mm.
And I think another thing we've been really good at is compartmentalising. So we could be in a discussion now and disagree on something, but then we can park it and start a brand new conversation in a totally different light. And I think we know each other's, you know, we know how to, you know, pull the plug on something if it's not going somewhere.
Yeah.
And say, right, park that, and maybe me and Ryan will go off and, you know, come up with a different plan and come back to Martin, or vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's been good as well, good at compartmentalising, where we can say, right, we're not going to solve that issue in this type of thinking. What about this customer? What about that? You know, and move on and can start again. We can do that really well within a meeting. The exact same meeting, the exact same car drive, we could have an argument and then go, right, stop, and go again. So I think that helps as well, just being sort of mature about it.
There's kind of a shorthand as well that you can use when it's three brothers, that if it was, you know, two strangers on the other side of the table, it would take you an extra hour to explain your perspective. But you could say that the interpersonal HR policy can be cutthroat at times.
Some would call it efficient.
It's very efficient, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, I was at a family business event speaking at it yesterday, and one of the points made was that a family business run well is the best business that there is. Mm-hmm. And that's an important thing to nurture and develop, and it's going good to date and it should go better in the future.
Absolutely.
I think we've also, I don't know if we always achieve it, but we also think of the other people, because it started with just the three of us, you know, the next person in. You know, our mother used to say that she had sons all over the place, because every time we brought somebody else into Seaton Matters, they kind of treat them as, you know, try and keep that family feel. And even in the communication, you know, that you don't have to go through a politically correct procedure. You can call someone out and say, here, what about this? What about that? You know, shorthand and move on again. And,
yeah.
You know, one of the images that we have at Seaton Matters is the Brownlee brothers, where, you know, we talk about the Seating Matters DNA. The DNA is, D is driven by growth, N is never give up, and A is a servant's heart. And the Brownlee brothers, we have as the picture of that. You know, the one where they're like almost at the finish line and one of them's fell and the other one comes over and puts his arm around them. And that's what we try to build, not just within the brothers, but within the wider team,
yeah.
That you'll put your arm around somebody and get them over the finish line, you know, and that comes first. And, you know, I think we've taken that model and trying to expand it into, you know, outside of the three brothers.
Yeah.
And we have to be very purposeful in that, because we're at the point a few years ago where we actually can't run the business ourselves. And we've brought in a management team who are actually each running their own department, and we're kind of overseeing it. And we're looking at acquisition as well. We've, you know, two companies in the works at the minute that we're looking to bring into the Seaton Matters family. And that building that real team culture and that DNA, acting like the Brownlee brothers, if one of us falls down, that I'll sacrifice myself to go and put my arm around and bring him up. And we're trying to instill that in our team. And as the team grows, you know, we have to be very deliberate in cultivating that, because it doesn't happen by accident. And the other thing, we haven't done it before. So we're learning as we go along, and our team are brilliant because they are far better than us in so many different things. You know, salespeople that are much better at sales than us, clinical researchers that know much more about medical conditions than us, educators who are far better speakers than us. And all we're doing is kind of bringing that team together and helping them work together.
Yeah.
We're also very aware as well that people don't so much listen to what we say, but they watch what we do.
Mm.
So we're very aware that, you know, for us to build a culture, we need to be living and eating, sleeping and breathing the culture. We need to be that culture. We need to be we need to be the people that we want our people to be.
Mm.
So they're watching our every move. If we do something out of character or kind of diversify away from our DNA, that is all noticed, and we're noticeable, and we're very, very aware of that. So it's something that we remind ourselves of a lot.
And we're not perfect at it, but it's something, I think that's why a lot of companies shy away from being outspoken about their culture, because it's hard to be perfect. It's hard to say this is what we are, because you're not always 100% like that. You know, you're going to drift off.
Yeah.
And then it stands out. So it's easier to shy back and not put it in writing and tell the world, you know, make YouTube videos.
Yeah.
Because then if you go outside of that, you know, nobody's calling you out on it. Whereas, like, it's very obvious when we do something. And it's probably more obvious to us than it is even to others. But I think that's, if you have...
And the best example of that is a few weeks ago when we were called out on it, and someone in the team says, look, I don't think that is in line with our principles. I don't think we should do that. And we're like, fair enough. Yep, you're exactly right. Yeah, let's stop, change, turn, because you're right and I'm wrong.
Yeah.
You know, and that's class. Yeah. That's just brilliant to have that.
Crazy. Wrapping up, do you guys have a mission? Do you have a vision? Do you have a clarified purpose?
We have a full book that describes our... So there's a book called The Vivid Vision that talks about mission statements not being clear enough, and we had a mission statement that the three of us understood, but it was really hard for our customers to know, well, what does that mean for me? Or it was hard for someone working in the factory or one of our distributors. So we have created a whole book called The Vivid Vision, and it outlines over probably 28, 30 pages what that is. So we'd be happy to share that with anybody. It's really hard to get into, a 28-pager book in one line. That's the point, that the mission statement isn't.
Between the three of you, could you roughly describe the direction that you want to go and the impact you want to make?
I think, again, what Ryan said, it's pull from the customer. You know, you look at, could you guess how much pressure injuries or bed sores cost the UK every year?
Not even remotely.
Billions and billions and billions of pounds. Something like £3.7 billion is what it costs the health service. That's only the financial cost. And then the emotional cost of someone actually suffering an open wound on their backside that has to be dressed three times a day. Knowing that 60% of those older adults will die within a year of getting a pressure ulcer, and knowing that 95% of them are completely avoidable. Right? So knowing that is the reality in healthcare all around the world. We, as I said before, we have an obligation to help those people. So, you know, before we had the Vivid Vision book, we said we want to change the world through healthcare seating. And that's what that meant to us, I suppose. There's people suffering and dying in care homes and hospitals in their own homes because of these pressure injuries. If only we could get a product underneath them at the right time and help that caregiver care for that patient and help that patient, you know, get rehabilitated or be comfortable, that would be success for us. So that's what drives us, and I suppose that's the overriding mission.
Yeah, the story that I always use is the long-haul flight. So we talked earlier, you've been, you know, all over the world. You get on that plane and you sit for, you know, 10, 8, 10, 12 hours. The last thing you'd want to do is be told you're back on that plane tomorrow morning and fly back to here again. And then the next day get you on the plane and fly again. And the next day, and the next day, and the next day. But for people living in hospitals and nursing homes all around the world, they're doing the equivalent of a long-haul flight every single day of their life. Can you imagine the quality of life? Imagine how uncomfortable that is. If you're sitting on a plane, we're able to get up and move. And once the bell goes, we'll get up and make an excuse to use the toilet, or we'll stretch and we'll move.
Yeah.
If you have a spinal injury and you can't stretch or move, or you can't reposition yourself, you know, it's just not a great quality of life at all. And there's so many people like that that we know our product can help. And, you know, if we can help more and more and more. And, you know, it's got to the stage, it's not just one more at a time. We're helping hundreds of people a week.
Yeah.
And the people that are looking after them, you know, think of their life. If we can make their job easier, you know, most of these healthcare facilities around the world are understaffed. And, you know, so if we can make their day a bit easier, you know, our part of our DNA, a servant's heart, is modelled off a hospice nurse or an ICU nurse. You know, they are going out of their way. Like, I don't know if you, the last time you've, you know, maybe been to where your wife works, but, or I'm sure you're waiting on her coming home, and an hour later she's, you know, she pops her head in the door because something happened. You know, they're doing 12-hour shifts and, you know, oh, I'm away, see you later. And an hour later, they're still there. You know, it's just, if we can make that person's life a bit easier, it's such a massive need.
Yeah.
It's just unbelievable. So that's what drives us, and that's what our mission is. And it's not easy to put into one sentence, which that book highlighted to us. And
yeah.
So
class. Final question. It's the question we always end on. If you could go back in time, each of you, to an 18-year-old version of yourself, and you could have a couple of minutes of 18-year-old Martin, 18-year-old Ryan, 18-year-old Jonathan's time, what sort of things would you personally say to them?
Mine stands out to me a wee bit. I think, so when we were working, and, you know, we grew up working, Martin said that, you know, the first time he was in the gates of the football club was when he took his son. And I'd done martial arts when I was at school, and I stopped for 15 years. That's probably the biggest regret I have. I'm back at it again now, and hopefully don't give it up again. But I do think, you know, that's probably something I would have stuck at.
Yeah.
I think it gives you a much more rounded life when you can, you know. I don't believe in balance. I don't believe balance achieves anything. And I think that's maybe why I don't regret anything. I spent 3 years, 300 nights a year in hotels around America, traveling and working. But there's definitely a few things. If I was going back to 18, I might have changed a wee bit of that.
Yeah.
So that's maybe something that I would think of just off the top of my head.
Brilliant.
Yep. Something I would say is, I'll give a good example. There's a young girl working at Seat Matters at the minute. I won't say her name, but she's not sure where she wants to go. She's not sure in her direction. She's not sure what does the future look like. And I was talking to her, I'm kind of coaching her a wee bit. And a few weeks ago I said, you should spend the next year learning. Don't worry about doing this or doing that. Or she believes she's 20 or 21 and she hasn't done enough, or she's not moving ahead quick enough. And I said, just spend time to learn. If you invest in learning, that will actually fast track. Whenever you do decide what you want to do, that'll fast track it. So I think for anybody listening to this, don't get too uptight about not knowing what direction you're going or what your purpose is or what your vision is. Just learn. Expand your reading material. Read books. Read lots of books. Similar to what Mark does. Mark's brilliant at that. He reads so many books. But just learn. And then when you find out what your passion or your vision is, it'll be boosted by the learning.
Is there one area of learning that you specifically to yourself would have encouraged you to go wee bit deeper on sooner?
Lean.
Yeah, just gonna lean. Say. Save all your pocket money and move to Japan.
I think personal development is the best learning, because that can be applied to anything that you go and do. I would say developing yourself, investing in yourself is the best investment you can make. People always say, oh, I want to get into property or invest in this or invest in stocks and shares. Invest in yourself is probably the best investment you can make.
For me, if you're 18 and you're looking for the future, get interviewed by the Best of Belfast. I think, like, as an 18-year-old, I've been asked actually to speak at the graduation for the local secondary school. And I would say, like, it'll be all right. You know, you'll figure things out. Don't be afraid of hard work, you know, and, you know, put your phone down. Facebook, YouTube, Instagram, all that fucking nonsense.
Yep.
You know, put your phone down and go and do a day's work, because, like, people look at, Elon Musk and look what he done, and you look at all these, you know, Instagram celebrities and whatever. Like, you take the most successful person in any field, they're working bloody hard at that. And I think that's a missing element perhaps in a sector of the population, you know, that 18-year-old population. Do a hard day's work. Like, people come to work in Seat Matters, and it doesn't matter who they are, what they are, you know, male, female, young, old, educated, not educated, experienced, no experience. If that person comes and says, I'll be the first one here tomorrow morning and I'll do a great day's work, you'd be saying, geez, that person's got potential.
Yeah.
You know, it's very simple advice, but I think it's very important advice.
For me, this whole conversation, it comes back to the turf. And there's a quote that I don't know who shared this with me, and they said, sometimes having faith that moves mountains looks an awful lot like walking towards a mountain with a pickaxe in your hand. And it's like you said earlier, it's the combination of you need the books, but you need the action.
Yeah.
And I think all three of you guys model that very well, where you do the hard work, but you also do the work you're talking about, Ryan, where you work on yourself and you do the development. Guys, thank you for your time. I really, really appreciate it. It's been a blast.
Thank you. It's been brilliant.
Thanks.